Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 13th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back two return guests to Teleforum. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, and then some back and forth, and then, as always, your questions, so please do be ready with those questions. We're going to begin with Professor Stephen I. Vladek. He's the professor of law at American University Washington College of Law right here in Washington, D.C., and then we'll hear from Adam J. White. He's a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institute. With that, Professor Vladek, please go right ahead.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to Dean. Thanks also to Tim Courtney and to Adam and to all you who are listening. This whole conversation actually sprung out of a Twitter debate that Adam and I got into. And so let me sort of take this opportunity as a shameless plug that you should follow Adam on Twitter. It's at Adam J. White, D.C. And if you want to be pissed off, you may follow me too, which is at Steve underscore Vladek. And this is all in response to an op-ed that my colleague at American, Amanda Frost, and I published in the New York Times in December about the challenge brought by Texas and 25 other states to President Obama's deferred immigration policy. And the timing of this teleforum couldn't be better because this Friday, the Supreme Court is set to consider the United States' petition for certiorari in the Texas versus U.S. case from the Fifth Circuit. So we might know as soon as this Friday afternoon whether the court's going to take this case up this term, and if so, whether the standing question in that case is going to be at issue. So just really briefly, let me walk through the Texas lawsuit, what the standing issue is, and then why I and certainly my colleague Professor Frost think that the Supreme Court should reverse solely on standing grounds. So the lawsuit obviously is a challenge to the deferred immigration, the deferred action policy that President Obama promulgated in November of 2014. Pursuant to the policy, the executive branch vows to not deport particular classes of immigrants who are the parents of individuals who are lawfully admitted, or in some cases the children of individuals who are lawfully admitted who are not citizens, based on certain promises that they make, that they'll be entitled to work authorization, and that they should be therefore treated as individuals who are not unlawfully present in the United States. Texas, joined by 25 of its sister states, brought a lawsuit in federal district court in Texas, arguing that the deferred action program was both a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act and was unconstitutional as a violation of basically President Obama's Article II authority insofar as he was exceeding the authority Congress had delegated to him by statute. The district court agreed and entered a preliminary injunction. The government appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and a divided panel of the Fifth Circuit agreed with the district court, and the case has now gotten to the Supreme Court. Now, in both the district court and in the Fifth Circuit, the courts relied upon Texas's argument for standing that the injury Texas is suffering by dint of the deferred action program is the extra financial costs Texas will incur to issue driver's licenses to all the individuals who qualify under the deferred action program. Basically, Texas's argument goes, these individuals are supposed to be able to obtain some form of identification once they're in the United States. We would presumably have to provide them with driver's licenses, and it would cost us, the state, money to do so, or at the very least, we would have to raise the fee for driver's licenses. We would have to take some voluntary action we don't want to take. And both the district court and the Fifth Circuit thought that was sufficient for standing. And suffice it to say, I think that's incorrect, and for three different reasons that I want to briefly sketch out. So the first reason why I think there's no standing in this case is because I don't know how this is an injury to the states as such. So for example, the government in its cert petition, I think, makes a very compelling argument that the only injury Texas suffers here is one it has voluntarily incurred by deciding to provide driver's licenses. The deferred action program does not require Texas to provide driver's licenses. It does not require Texas to absorb the cost of driver's licenses. It does not require Texas to basically do anything that Texas doesn't choose to do. And in most other contexts, of course, the Supreme Court has said voluntary action is usually not enough to confer standing. Second, let's assume that that's not even true. Let's assume that it's more convincing to you, the listeners, and to Adam, that Texas really is suffering an injury by choosing to issue driver's licenses to these individuals in order to comply with the deferred action program. Even if that's true, how is that injury different than the injury every other state would suffer by dint of this program? That is to say, Texas perhaps may have more individuals who qualify for some kind of deferred action under President Obama's policy, but there's nothing unique to Texas here that would explain why it suffers an injury that isn't suffered as well by California, by New Mexico, by Maine, by Washington, really by every state. And I think for standing analysis, the Supreme Court has always insisted that the plaintiff has to be able to show some specific reason why it is injured in a way that everyone else like it is not. And so to my mind, an injury that is suffered by all 50 states equally is the exact kind of injury the Supreme Court has historically been very skeptical of recognizing for standing purposes. Now, the third and I think most doctrinally centric reason why I think the Fifth Circuit erred in conferring standing upon Texas here is in contrast to the Supreme Court's most recent case involving a state suit like this one, Massachusetts versus EPA. So in Massachusetts versus EPA, Massachusetts was suing the Environmental Protection Agency basically for its failure to promulgate rules related to global warming, and Massachusetts claimed as a large part of its injury that as a substantial owner of coastal property, it was going to be particularly affected by rising sea levels resulting from global warming in ways that, for example, Iowa and Kansas would not be. And the Supreme Court, there's language in Massachusetts that cuts both ways, but the Supreme Court relied on that to a large degree and also relied on the extent to which the APA actually gave Massachusetts a very specific procedural right that Massachusetts then purported to sue under. There's no similar procedural right here. I mean, the INA, you know, the federal immigration law, doesn't recognize states as relevant parties when it comes to challenging federal immigration policy. And I think that's for good reason. So those are three sort of doctrinal reasons why I think the Fifth Circuit was incorrect. But before turning over to Adam, let me sort of step back a bit and also offer three broader reasons why I think, in general, it just doesn't make sense to allow states to sue whenever the federal government adopts a policy that might require all of the states to change something about one of their licensing regimes. So the first and perhaps the most longstanding argument against this theory of broad state standing is the longstanding view the Supreme Court has taken about the extent to which states are not parens patriae of their citizens when it comes to federal law, right? That when it comes to federal law, the federal constitution, federal statutes, it's the federal government, not the state, that is parens patriae. And that's been the law of the Supreme Court since Massachusetts versus Mellon in 1922, and for good reason. States may have different views about federal laws. Look at the Texas case, where there are 25 states as plaintiffs, leaving the other 25 not in the case. So that's one, and the theory behind why we don't want states proceeding as parens patriae is because their sovereignty is not implicated to the same degree by challenges to federal policy when they're not possessing rights as such. The second broader reason why states shouldn't have standing in this context is because of the doors it would open if they did. So imagine if the Supreme Court decides to take this case and holds that Texas and the other plaintiff states do have standing and then reaches the merits one way or the other. I have to think that that would pave the way for any number of other lawsuits by states challenging all manners of federal policies, and as in this case, perhaps even obtaining preliminary injunctive relief to prevent those policies from going into effect. That would be the exact kind of, I think, aggressive judicial interference with federal policy that the Supreme Court standing doctrine has long been designed to avoid, turning the court effectively into a council of revision. Because let's be frank, right? We all have states that we're more sympathetic to and less sympathetic to that would challenge federal policies that we're more sympathetic to and less sympathetic to. But once you allow Texas to sue in a case like this, what's to stop Vermont from suing to challenge a future president who goes in a different direction on a similar policy? And then the third, and this comes from a 1966 Law Review article by Alex Bickel. Adam and I were talking about this beforehand. You know, I'm not always the biggest fan of Bickel, but on this he was exactly right. Bickel was talking about the Supreme Court's decision in South Carolina versus Katzenbach, and he said, quote, "To allow the states to litigate in this fashion would be a fundamental denial of perhaps the most innovating principle of the Constitution, the principle that the federal government is a sovereign coexisting in the same territory with the states and acting not through them, like some international organization, but directly upon the citizenry, which is its own as well as theirs, unquote. So just to be clear, before I turn it over to Adam, it's not my view that states never have standing. I actually wrote a law review article a few years back titled States' Rights and State Standing, where I suggested the exact circumstances where I thought states can and should be able to sue the federal government, and that's where the states possess a specific right as such against the federal government. So for example, in the lawsuits challenging the Affordable Care Act, I think we can draw a super bright distinction between the efforts of states like Virginia to challenge the individual mandate, which the Fourth Circuit, in my view, correctly dismissed for lack of standing, and the efforts of states like Florida to challenge the Medicaid expansion, which was actually a direct act against the states, that if you agree with the majority in NFIB, was coercing the states as such. I think, you know, we could have an interesting conversation about which rights count as states' rights that can be enforced in this regard and what kinds of injuries would be enough. But I just have to say that at the end of the day, if the Texas injury in the immigration case the Supreme Court will conference on Friday falls on that side of the line, I'm hard-pressed to think of injuries to states arising from the enforcement of federal policies that wouldn't. And so with that, I'll shut up and turn it over to Adam.
Well, thanks, Steve. And I chuckled at your comment up front about how our conversation started. You're probably a bit too generous when you said that it started as a Twitter debate, if only because it's usually too generous to call any debate on Twitter a real debate. I saw your op-ed and offered a couple of quick comments, partly with an eye to Massachusetts v. EPA, which you mentioned. I'll get back to. But again, I'm glad we're getting a chance to do this here in the Federal Society. I have some thoughts on the Texas case specifically, and then some of the broader considerations that you sketched out on in your op-ed with Professor Frost, and then just now on the call. So let me say at the outset, I don't think, with respect to Texas and their standing, this case is a particularly close call. I think Texas definitely has standing to challenge the president's deferred action policy under the well-established standards for standing that the Supreme Court and lower courts have spelled out over the years. You know, the baseline test for standing under the Lujan case and others is you need injury that's caused by the defendant's action and that's redressable by the court. With respect to injury, it has to be actual or imminent, has to be concrete and particularized and not just a hypothetical grievance. Now, I think Texas does have an actual concrete particularized injury. The policy will cost the state millions of dollars, and we'll get into this, but it'll cost the state millions of dollars because the federal documentation of the immigrant's lawful presence in the United States and the state of Texas will entitle the immigrants under Texas law to Texas driver's licenses. In the Court of Appeals opinion, they said it's a net cost of about $130 per license. That's the cost the state bears. As the lower court, the district court, pointed out, that, you know, this might not sound like much when you're talking about an individual license, but if 25,000 people apply for licenses now because of this new lawful presence, and I think the district court said that's about 5% of the people that stand to benefit. If just 5% of the people, 25,000 people, newly apply for licenses, that's going to immediately cost the state $3.25 million. I'm a lawyer, so math isn't my strong suit, but if, say, 15% of the possible people apply, that's $16 million, and so on. So when Professor Vladek's op-ed called this a minimal amount of money, I just simply disagree. I think it's a substantial amount of money. I think that financial loss is an injury. Financial loss is an injury under black letter law. Now, to avoid this, the administration and other critics of the lawsuit have pressed some main arguments, which Steve's outlined. One is that Texas's injury is self-inflicted because Texas could change its own laws to withhold licenses from this subset of individuals in the state. Or the another response is that the injury is too generalized and not particularized with respect to Texas. Now, I don't think this injury is self-inflicted, as the Fifth Circuit and the District Court recognized. Standing can't be, an injury isn't wiped away. Standing can't be defeated by simply telling the plaintiff to change his or her own conduct, and that's black letter law. If a defendant's actions force the plaintiff to change his own conduct, then it's an injury. And I think the way that Steve characterized it in passing at the outset is a little telling. And you know, like anything on a teleform debate, it might have been inadvertent, but I thought he said that he characterized Texas's arguments as we would have to take some voluntary action. I mean, there's two parts of that sentence, and you're going to believe one or the other. Either Texas has to take some action, in which case it's not voluntary, or it's voluntary and they don't have to take it. I think under the Supreme Court and D.C. Circuit case law, the basic standard is that if the defendant's conduct causes the impedes the plaintiff's pre-existing conduct and he has to make a change to that conduct, it's not really voluntary. It's an injury. The alternative defense, one that's pressed by Professor Vladek, although, and I haven't followed the case as closely as others, so I don't know if the Justice Department's pushed this, but I don't think they have, is that the financial injury to Texas isn't particularized, since, as Steve argues, other states may well share the same injury. This argument was, I think, rejected in the district court and Fifth Circuit, and I think for good reason, because I think it miscomprehends what it means for an injury to be concrete and particularized. Now, with respect to particularized, it doesn't mean shared by many people. That's a point that the D.C. Circuit really emphasized in a 2007 case called Public Citizen versus National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The court explained that, quote, the fact that a number of people could be similarly injured does not render the claim an impermissible generalized grievance. Where harm is concrete, though widely shared, the court has found injury in fact. And again, here in this case with Texas, I think the harm is definitely concrete. It's the loss of money. The question is, again, whether the injury affects the plaintiff in a personal or individual way. In that D.C. Circuit case, the court analogized this argument to, say, a car accident where multiple people are injured. It's one accident, and everybody's injured, but that doesn't make it a generalized injury because everybody in the car is injured in an individual way. I mean, I'd analogize it maybe to, say, a mining company that accidentally spills wastewater and floods a nearby town. You know, the fact that the wastewater might touch every yard or field doesn't mean that each individual landowner isn't personally injured. You know, the injury hurts everybody, but it hurts them each in an individual way. And this is itself an argument that the Supreme Court touched on in the Massachusetts v. EPA case, which I'll return to later. The majority wrote in a footnote in defense of the state's standing that to deny standing to persons who are injured in fact simply because many others are also injured would mean that the most injurious and widespread government actions could be questioned by nobody. We cannot accept that conclusion, the court said. I'd actually contrast this type of injury that's widespread but particularized with, say, the types of injuries that were alleged in the Clapper case recently, the national surveillance case, where the government was allegedly sweeping up everybody's communications. The plaintiffs lost. They lacked standing because, if I remember correctly, their allegations that they were personally injured weren't concrete enough. They were too hypothetical. But I think it's a good example, much like greenhouse gas emissions or something that touch on everybody. The allegations about surveillance were that they touched on that everybody was being surveyed, and therefore, you know, in some senses, you generalized grievance unless you can show that you are yourself actually being surveilled. Now, quite frankly, when I read Steve's op-ed in the first instance, I immediately thought of Massachusetts v. EPA. That was the case where the state's alleged injuries, I think, were far more speculative than Texas's million-dollar burdens. Now, Steve, you know, outlined this. Texas had alleged that global sea levels had risen about 10 to 20 centimeters over the 20th century as a result of global warming. The dissent noted that this was, the dissent, I guess, argued that this was entirely speculative. They hadn't connected the sea level rises to the EPA's failure to reduce greenhouse gases and so on. But as the dissent said in that case, global climate change seems the quintessential generalized grievance. They quoted Judge Sentell, who I did happen to clerk for. Judge Sentell had pointed out that global climate change was a phenomenon that's harmful to humanity at large, to literally change the atmosphere around the world, and that seemed to the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court dissenters as more of a generalized grievance. Now, in Massachusetts, the five-justice majority found it necessary in the standing analysis to put at least a rhetorical thumb on the scales in favor of the plaintiff's standing. They said that states are entitled to special solicitude, their term, quote, special solicitude, in claiming standing to defend sovereign or quasi-sovereign interests against the federal government. Now, it wasn't clear to me then, and it's not really clear to me now, what the majority meant in that case. It sounds cynical, but I got the sense that was a ticket that was good for just one ride, and it hasn't really been sketched out since then. I don't think the state should get special solicitude for standing, at least in the general sense that the five-justice majority stated, and I think this is a point where Steve and I would agree. that there shouldn't be special solicitude. I'd add, I think state standing should be evaluated under the exact same standing doctrines as everybody else. And again, under those standards, I think it's an easy case here. And for similar reasons, I agreed with the Fourth Circuit's decision that was alluded to earlier, where the Fourth Circuit rejected Virginia's lawsuit challenging Obamacare's individual mandate. In that case, Virginia's only claim to standing was that it had passed a law after the fact purporting to immunize its citizens from the federal mandate. Virginia, unlike Texas, didn't claim burdens directly on the state as a state. It wasn't even arguing really that the mandate preempted pre-existing state law. And the Fourth Circuit, I think, stressed that preemption of pre-existing general state law is an injury for purposes of state standing. But here, Virginia hadn't even done that. The state was just trying to stand in between its citizens and the federal government to challenge federal policy. And like Steve said, the states don't have standing to litigate against the federal government as parens patriae on behalf of their own citizens. So, you know, to borrow the terms that Steve's focused on, Virginia's alleged injury in that case wasn't concrete and it wasn't particularized with respect to the state. Just a couple last points. As much as I doubt special solicitude, though, I equally reject the opposite notion of, say, special unsolicitude, which I think is what Steve is effectively arguing for in his op-ed. He's singling out states as states because they're states and trying to make it harder for them to have standing in court than ordinary individual personal plaintiffs would. And I think this is mistaken. I don't think it has any roots in the Constitution or in constitutional precedents. And I think the policy justifications that he's offered in the op-ed that he wrote with Professor Frost and on the phone now, I think those are unavailing. There's the argument that if Texas's standing is affirmed, then state officials might use the courts to delay implementation of federal policies with which they disagree. I think this is basically a red herring. If a federal policy is unlawful, either because it's unconstitutional or because it violates the APA or some other federal law, then of course the states, like any other plaintiffs, should be allowed to challenge this in court so long as they meet the basic constitutional standards for standing. Relatedly, when he argues in his op-ed that litigation is not an alternative to the political process, at least in this case, I'd ask, what political process? The government policy being challenged here isn't a law passed by Congress that the states could have tried to influence in the legislative debates. It wasn't even a regulation passed through notice and comment for which the states could have filed comments. The deferred action policy was simply imposed by the president and the administrative state on everybody else without any political process. So this isn't litigation that's taking the place of political process. This is litigation in the absence, the forced absence of a political process. And I think this highlights precisely why it's important for the courts to keep the courthouse doors open. Not open them wider than usual, but not close them. A few years ago, there was an article by Professor Jillian Metzger. It was called Administrative Law as the New Federalism. And she observed that administrative action increasingly implicates federalism, either because Congress delegates broad powers to the agencies or because the agencies just claim broad powers. And the key line, it's one that I've always kept with me, is, quote, administrative law may be becoming the home of a new federalism. I think that's true, and I think for exactly that reason, it's precisely backwards to promote a special unsolicitude against ordinary state standing. And my very last point, you know, maybe I'm being unfair when I call it special unsolicitude. I don't think I am, but even setting that aside, I do think the approach urged in the op-ed is a different kind of special solicitude, and one that I also disagree with. I think it's a special solicitude towards unilateral presidential power that's insulated from judicial review. And I think that Texas's lawsuit is drawing broad attention, not just in this op-ed, but more broadly in political and academic circles, precisely because it seems like a viable challenge to the administration, just as many, though certainly not all, previous state suits in the last 8 or 16 years have often proved to be. So I've spoken at length now, and I didn't mean to go on so long, but again, thank you very much for having me.
Sure thing. A lot has been said. I do want to get to audience questions. Why don't I open the floor to questions, but then I want, before we take a question, to give you each a chance to expand a bit, but not another 12 minutes. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Professor Vladek, you want to take a minute or two to respond to what you heard from Adam White?
Sure. I mean, I think, let me just be very clear. I mean, I think it's clear to folks where we disagree. But Professor Frost and I do not have the view that states are specially unentitled to bring lawsuits. We didn't say that in our op-ed, and we don't believe that. Nor do we believe that the executive branch is specially protected from lawsuits that would otherwise be available. What we're arguing for is that states aren't entitled to special solicitude, at least when they're suing the federal government, and indeed that all the other cases where the Supreme Court has used the special solicitude language has been where states have sued other parties, including private companies, or cases where states have been enforcing federal rights that they possess as states. This is not that case. This is also not the case of the mining spill. Texas is not in some special geographic position vis-a-vis all the other states with regard to immigrants who are protected by the Deferred Action Program. And most importantly, I mean, for Adam to be right, we would have to believe that any old plaintiff, not just the state, could bring this kind of lawsuit against the federal government. There's no suggestion in the record that any other state couldn't have brought this suit. Adam's theory is that any person could have brought this suit, and I think that's the exact kind of standing analysis that the court has rejected in every other context. For it to accept it here is to suggest that states really are special when, in fact, when they're suing the federal government, states are just like us. They have some rights, they don't have others, and that really ought to be the end of the story.
Adam White.
Sorry, I was on mute. Just to be clear, I don't think I certainly didn't mean to suggest, and I don't think I did suggest that literally everybody has standing to challenge this particular policy. What I'm arguing is that everybody's standing should be evaluated under the exact same standards. Now, some people and some entities will have standing where others don't. I think it's quite possible that an individual person or a company might be injured by this policy in their own personal way, and that would give them standing. I haven't really given that much thought to other prospective plaintiffs. You know, it occurred to me as I was listening to Steve's initial remarks that there's this presumption that Texas is like many other states in terms of its policies that are giving rise to the basis of this theory of standing. I don't know for a fact that that's true. I don't know what other states have claimed for their standing. But it's interesting. I mean, I think by Stephen's logic, if it were the case that Texas were literally the only state to have this sort of injury based on the driver's license laws, I mean, maybe I misunderstand, but I think then even under his own standard, Texas would have standing because it would have an injury different from everybody else's. I don't think that's the right standard, but if that is the standard, if Texas is the only state with a policy, then it would have standing. So if standing is then defeated, not because of what the defendant has done or is doing, but because of what other third parties, other states might be doing in terms of their own policies, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think you look at the effect of the government's policy, the federal government, on the individual state, and it's in this case, it's financial resources.
Very good. I announced that the floor is open. Our lines are wide open right now. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if we get a question from the audience, there are a lot of people online, but no questions yet. Let me ask a question of Adam White. I think I heard Professor Vladek say that if standing is found in this case, it would open the door to many such challenges on any policies. Maybe engage in the thought experiment a little bit. If the tables were turned here, and if this is a policy you favor, you know, would your analysis be the same, or do you disagree with the idea that this would open the door to challenges of almost or many federal policies, I should say?
Well, listen, I'll be candid. I mean, I'm sure my initial gut reaction to a lawsuit depends on which side of the political table I might be sitting at, right? When Massachusetts v. EPA was handed down, I'm sure I flinched at the court's standing analysis, even before getting to the special solicitude point, where in hindsight, the real has been a real crux of my disagreement with that case. that might be my initial instinct. I'd like to think that I'd take a consistent approach regardless of the president and the plaintiffs. Once given an opportunity to sort of reflect further and look at the specific pleadings, I don't doubt that there are, say, conservative or Republican regulatory or executive policies that might impose burdens on states. If, say a Republican administration took executive action that purported to wipe away state to wipe away barriers to say illegal immigrants getting gun licenses or people in general getting gun licenses, I'd have to think about what that might be. I sort of kicked the idea around, but haven't thought it through that much. I could see states being injured by that. Likewise, if say the next administration takes particularly strong action against illegal immigration in a way that goes directly to, say, state finances, that might directly implicate state finances or even might purport to preempt state laws, then I could see the states having standing. And all of this is separate from whether the states would have a viable claim on the merits. And I think it's always important, and I don't think Steve would disagree, that the merits and the standing analysis, though intertwined slightly, are still very distinct.
Professor Vladek, do you want to get in on this point?
I mean, I certainly agree that the merits are distinct. I think the problem is that to allow Texas to have standing in a case like this means a couple of different things. First, it means at the very least that all 50 states could have brought this lawsuit, and, you know, bracket whether individuals who could also show some similar kind of economic injury might also have standing to bring this lawsuit. But second, I mean, I think it's worth considering, even without regard to the merits, you know, are we really that excited at the prospect of every single federal policy being challenged in federal court by at least one or two or a handful of states? You know, find me a federal policy that all 50 states support, and I'll find you a federal policy that doesn't do anything. I guess, you know, this is what Alex Bickel was writing about in 1966. He was writing about the very real specter that instead of waiting for individual plaintiffs who can show some very specific injury, allowing states to sue based on some very general injury to their sovereign interest. And even in this case, allowing Texas to sue based on an injury to their pocketbook that at most is an injury that's no different from every other state, is opening the doors to the kind of litigation the Supreme Court standing doctrine has turned its back on for decades. Now, Dean, let me be clear. I mean, I am probably a broader supporter of broad theories of standing than Adam is. My frustration here is that, you know, folks who are typically very skeptical of broad conceptions of standing seem only too happy to let Texas bring this lawsuit. And folks, you know, who tend to be very pro broad theories of standing have been very skeptical of Texas. I think we need to be consistent. And at least based on what the Supreme Court has done in other contexts, Texas can't show the kind of unique injury that the Supreme Court has allowed to justify standing in other contexts. And so if you allow standing here, one of two things is going to be true. Either you're allowing standing more generally for everybody, or you're allowing standing more generally for states. I'm actually more willing to accept that allowing standing more generally for everybody might be a useful thing. I can't imagine that's what anyone, you know, or at least most of the folks listening to this call would actually want.
You know, and since I, you know, so much of this call is about about disagreement, I do want to reiterate a point that I made to Steve at the outset. I mean, I very much am cognizant of Alex Bickel's warnings. I think he made very good points about the effect of over litigation of policy. I'm always glad where scholars like Steve focus on Bickel's writings. I disagree a little with his take on the implications of that. I won't get into that, but I would say in terms of worrying about a world in which policy disputes regularly become litigation, I mean, it's more or less always been such, right? There's another line I love from Tocqueville where he says, scarcely any political question arises in the United States that's not resolved sooner or later into a judicial question. That's him writing before the Civil War about the state of law and politics in America. And, you know, so I don't think we're really moving away from something that wasn't always there in one way or another.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question on the board. I'll get to that momentarily. But first, the announcement about our upcoming call schedule. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about judicial selection in our telephone conference call. Then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll have the Michael Lewis Memorial Teleforum, the first one. That's Friday at 1 p.m., all times Eastern Time. Let me ask a follow-up question, if I could, before we turn to the audience. And again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. About the unique injury or the particularized injury we've been hearing about, I wonder if, Professor Vladek, if you could say a little bit more about that. Is that vis-a-vis, for state standing, is that vis-a-vis the other 49 states or vis-a-vis what sort of entities? And does the math there make a difference in a particularized industry, in particularized injury when you're talking about a person's injury versus vis-a-vis all other people, or a corporation's injury vis-a-vis all other corporations, or a state's injury vis-a-vis just 49 other states?
Well, I mean, I think at the very least, I mean, it can't be an injury that's specific to Texas if it's an injury that all 50 states share equally. You know, and I think that's what the Supreme Court has said in other contexts about generalized versus particularized injuries. You know, Adam used the example of the mining accident or the pollution spill. You know, in that context, obviously, as you get farther and farther away from the source of the pollution, the injury dissipates so that you get to a point where there's no one else with that injury. But Texas's claim here does not arise from its unique situation as, you know, one of the states with the longest borders in the United States. Its injury arises solely from the additional costs it says it's going to incur by dint of following this program. You know, even if we accept that is an injury, and as I suggested before, there are reasons to doubt that, that's not an injury that Texas suffers in any way uniquely because it's Texas. Same way with the Medicaid expansion, right? States that choose, states that did not want to be bound by the Medicaid expansion, right, were being, their claim was that Congress was effectively violating the spending clause by coercing state conduct, right? That's distinct from the claim that, you know, an individual person is being coerced by having to pay for, you know, health insurance through the individual mandate. I realize this gets a little bit complicated in the weeds, but all I'm trying to suggest is that for a state to have standing in a case like this, at least one of two things has to be true. One, the state has to be able to show some specific reason why it is injured in a way that not everyone else is. And or two, the state has to be able to show some specific federal right that it's seeking to enforce as such, that it holds itself and not just on behalf of its citizens. And the notion that President Obama is violating the APA and or Article 2 through the Deferred Action Program does not violate a right Texas holds as a state. If it's unlawful, it's unlawful generally, and that's why I think Bickel was so insistent on the political process, right? That, you know, the fact that Congress hasn't passed immigration reform doesn't mean the political process isn't a way of holding the political branches accountable.
Adam White, anything on this point?
Yeah, I disagree with the characterization that Texas's injury is one that all 50 states share equally. I've not seen any documentation to the extent to which other states have similar policies, let alone the idea that the magnitude of their injuries are similar. What Texas needs to show and what it did show is that it itself does suffer a direct financial injury, and that's enough. Even if other states widely share the sort of same category of injury, as long as each feel it in a direct way, an individualized way, that's enough. You know, this sort of doctrine arose, I mean, Lujan was an environmental case. What this was trying to get away from in the first instance was the idea that you could claim standing based not on direct and personal injury in a concrete way, but rather sort of a generalized opposition or sentiment against a policy. Say, you know, you very much like a lake or a pond that you visit, and that in and of itself should give you standing to challenge the federal government's regulation or failure of regulation regarding the environmental protection of that lake. And that truly is generalized. You know, I'd be curious to hear Steve's view of standing in Clapper, the surveillance case. If, for the sake of argument, the federal government was surveilling everybody, does that mean that literally nobody would have standing to sue? I don't think that would even be true, so long as an individual plaintiff could show that his actual conversations were themselves being surveilled. That's good enough, even if others had similar categories of injury.
So, I mean, let me be clear. I mean, I think Adam is mischaracterizing Clapper. The claim in Clapper was not that the government was collecting everyone's communications. The claim in Clapper was that under Section 702 of FISA, as amended by the FISA Amendments Act in 2008, the government was especially collecting the content of U.S. persons who communicated with non-U.S. persons overseas, which, I mean, I think we can all agree is not everybody. But I'll concede Clapper's a closer case on that front, and that the problem in Clapper was not that it was a generalized injury. The problem in Clapper was that these particular plaintiffs couldn't show proof that their communications as such had been intercepted, right? That's a different kind of standing problem. The better question I have for Adam is, what about a case like Allen versus Wright? In Allen versus Wright, you have parents of school children in a southern city, I think it was Memphis, right, who are challenging the IRS's refusal to enforce the federal regulation that denies tax-exempt status to schools that discriminate on the basis of race, to private schools discriminate on the basis of race. That's a pretty concrete injury. They could show a pretty clear, you know, connection between the claimed injury and the alleged violation of federal policy. They could show why the injury was affecting them as such. It wasn't hypothetical, as in Clapper, right? The reason why the court rejected that claim is because they thought it was too attenuated. It just wasn't clear enough that this was going on to affect these people specifically. I don't understand how the immigration policy that President Obama promulgated in November 2014 affects Texas specifically in a way that it doesn't affect everyone else, not just all the states, but private organizations, private persons, community support groups. I mean, everyone in this country receives a larger burden when there are more individuals in this country who are entitled to receive social services. Whether we think that's a good thing or a bad thing, it is not an injury that is uniquely felt by one state versus another. And so, you know, we may have different feelings about the merits or not, the wisdom or not, of President Obama's policy. All I'm trying to say is that Texas is not the only state or the only entity that bears the brunt of it. Not only that, but if everyone bears the brunt of a policy, then they can't have standing to sue. I mean, that's not me. That's Justice Scalia.
Yeah, I'd say, first off, with respect to Clapper, man, I do understand that Clapper was decided on other grounds, and I think I even alluded to that at the outset of the conversation, that Clapper, their standing was rejected not because it was a generalized grievance, but because it was their allegations were insufficiently concrete. What I was trying to get at my last question was...
The allegations were concrete. They couldn't prove, right, because all of the surveillance was secret. They couldn't prove that, in Justice Alito's words, the surveillance was, quote, certainly impending, unquote.
Right, exactly. But what I was saying in my last question was, more hypothetically, if it was the case in a Clapper-style case that the government literally was surveilling everybody, if the upshot of that is that then nobody has standing to sue, I'm not sure that I would agree with that. If an individual plaintiff could document through evidence and declarations that they were themselves personally being surveilled, I don't think the cases require that. I think Massachusetts v. EPA specifically disavowed that approach with respect to generalized grievances. Now, with respect to Allen v. Wright, I've got to admit, I can't remember off the top of my head what the facts of that case were, but I think with respect to any case, whether Allen v. Wright or anything else, regardless of the policy being challenged, my first question in this, my first instinct would be, what was in the record? What are the declarations supporting standing? And how do either of those bodies of evidence support the allegations of actual injury suffered by individual plaintiffs? For me, that's the standard, and that's because I think that's the standard prescribed by the Supreme Court, D.C. Circuit, and other courts.
Well, we do have one caller that's been patiently waiting for some time now with a question. If you'd like to join that queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone on mute. You need to take your own phone off mute if it's on mute.
Oh. Yes. So is it a matter of the separation of powers or federalism? I guess what I'm understanding is that there's maybe an arbitrary, I don't know if it's arbitrary and capricious standard, the parens patri or patre, I guess it's a constitutional provision that allows standing in the Supreme Court or Article III courts. Maybe there isn't a considered an injury, presumptively or maybe an actual injury to speak on behalf of the persons who aren't able to speak for themselves. So if it's a matter of establishing standing, is it, and the standard is overcome, I guess, it is arbitrary or capricious. Is it just a matter of separation of powers or federalism such that the administrative agencies would then handle the problems that the Article III courts within their jurisdiction would not handle, just to avoid, I guess, people who are private citizens versus people who are public citizens from, feeling that they are not protected under equal protection laws? Is it clear? I'm trying to... maybe sum it up more succinctly.
This is Adam. I mean, I think I understand the nut of your question. Just correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, why is it that states don't have parents patriae standing to challenge policies of the federal government to protect their citizens? I mean, I do think, I think that is rooted at least in part on notions of both federalism and the separation of powers. I think it reflects the fact that our government is one in which the federal government has a relationship directly with citizens, that states can't interpose themselves into. States have a relationship with their own citizens, and the federal government has a relationship with the states. So you can't have, with respect to that relationship between the federal government and American citizens, you can't just have the states stepping in, standing in the shoes of their citizens to block federal policy. That requires the citizens themselves to file those suits. And if the states want to sue, they have to have their own personalized concrete injury.
Like New York, it's more like Wicker v. Silver under Commerce Clause. I guess we are discussing the standing. This is my only follow-up question, following my shot, so to speak. The standing, I guess you said standing in the place of the citizens. So would it be more akin to a citizen or a state having the ability to bring a suit under a Commerce Clause provision, which is a separate provision, I guess, so to speak?
Wickard himself filed the lawsuit, right? It was his lawsuit challenging the federal government's overreach vis-a-vis federalism.
And in Wickard, right? I mean, I think Adam and I would agree both that there was a large class of plaintiffs in Wickard and that they all had standing, right? That is to say, Wickard to me is a paradigmatic example of a case in which there's a clear injury suffered by a large group of people, to wit, farmers who are subjected to the quotas under the AAA. I think it's worth stressing. I mean, there are cases where I think states clearly do have standing. Let me give you a good example. I mean, so South Carolina versus Katzenbach, which is one of the cases that Bickel was writing about in 1966, this is the first major challenge to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And South Carolina challenges a bunch of different provisions of the VRA, including the preclearance provisions, on a number of grounds. So South Carolina raises a bill of attainder argument. South Carolina raises a due process argument. And South Carolina argues that the VRA exceeds Congress's power under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. And the Supreme Court actually splits the difference. So the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion in South Carolina versus Katzenbach says we actually don't have the power to resolve South Carolina's due process and bill of attainder claims because we don't really see how South Carolina has standing to bring those claims. They're not injuries South Carolina is really suffering as such, as compared to injuries that are suffered by everybody at large. But we do have the power, the court said in Katzenbach, to reach the 15th Amendment claim because the whole point of a statute promulgated under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment is to regulate the states as such. Right? The 15th Amendment statutes are meant to displace state election laws. And so the court says, so obviously South Carolina is a proper party to bring that challenge. I don't think Adam and I disagree, and Adam should correct me if I'm wrong, that's actually a helpful way of thinking about, that a state can be much more obviously injured when it involves a right that is clearly possessed uniquely by the state as such. The complication arises in cases like this one, where a state's claiming that it's injured not based on some special right it has as a state, but just based on the ordinary criteria the court applies in standing cases. I don't think that that's a null set. I just think that it's perhaps a much smaller set than Adam does.
Yeah, I think that by and large, I agree with Katzenbach. There are some throwaway lines that I can't recall off the top of my head, but sort of just one sentence rejections of states having rights for purposes of due process. I disagree with that, but that's really immaterial to this particular conversation. I think by and large, Katzenbach is a reasonable decision. But again, it comes back to how did the states, specifically tried to allege standing. Katzenbach was a long time before Lujan and the other cases in which Lujan reiterated and recollected the basic standards for standing. Cases today by the states are filed, under a much clearer set of standing doctrines. And so, when it comes to evaluating state standing, I look to cases like Lujan and not to the sort of more airy analyses of Katzenbach. But yeah, I mean, I agree. I think Katzenbach's defense of the Civil Rights Act was a very good decision, by and large.
Our audience is waking up a little bit more. We've got a couple questions pending. We've got about 10 minutes left, so let's try and get through these two remaining questions. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Jimmy Conde in Washington, D.C. I just wanted to clarify something and then ask Steve a question. So in action, in Wicked versus Filburn, it was actually there was a penalty that was going to apply against Roscoe Filburn, and he brought a bill of complaint to enjoin the penalty. So he clearly had standing, so I wasn't sure what the other caller was referring to. But my question for Steve is, while you were talking about Massachusetts versus EPA, you were saying that Massachusetts had some sort of APA right or something of that sort to bring its challenge, whereas you seem to imply that Texas did not have any sort of APA rights. But here, clearly, Texas is challenging sort of a procedural flaw in the memorandum that saying it's a substantive rule and it does have an APA right, at least if it is within the supposed zone of interests of the statute. So were you saying that here it's just not in the zone of interests, or are you saying that this is not an APA case at all? I was kind of confused by your discussion of Massachusetts versus APA. EPA.
So I should be a little bit clearer. I'm sorry about that. So what I should have been clear about in my earlier comments is, so in Massachusetts versus EPA, it was an APA claim, but it was brought through the Clean Air Act. And there were provisions in the Clean Air Act that actually identified the specific kinds of injuries that ought to give rise to claims. So it wasn't just general APA zone of interest standing. It was actually a specific federal statute creating a right on the part of the state to petition and then to seek judicial review once the petition was denied. There's no similar provision in the INA here. That's what I was trying to say. And so, you know, I think it's a little bit it's reading EPA, I think, a little bit too broadly to suggest that that was covering any APA claim. It was actually more that it was a Clean Air Act claim brought through the review provisions of the APA, and that unlike the Clean Air Act in that case, the INA doesn't have any similar language here, and that's a distinction I think is worth the difference, because I think Congress does have the power to authorize states to sue by creating statutory injuries that might be uniquely suffered by the state. I just don't think there's any argument that that's what's happened here.
So just to clarify, you were talking about 307B of the Clean Air Act, is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, I don't. Adam knows these provisions better than I do, but that sounds familiar to me.
I don't know if I know him better than you. I am a little bit when you keep referring back to the INA. I mean, the first sentence of the Fifth Circuit's opinion said that. I guess first or second sentence said, this is a case where Texas claims that the Deferred Action Program violates the Administrative Procedure Act and the Take Care Clause. I mean, the APA very much does allow for lawsuits by states. I don't know that it singles them out for lawsuits as states, as, you know, per se, but I don't think I've never seen a doctrine that closed the APA judicial review provisions to state judicial review brought by states, unless a separate statute affirmatively authorizes the states to bring the case.
No, but I mean, I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that in Matthews versus EPA, the court did not say that any time the state has an APA claim, it has standing, right? That it was the combination of the specific language in the Clean Air Act together with the review provisions of the APA. And the flip side is, if states would have standing under the APA in all cases, then states can challenge just about all administrative action that has even, you know, a modest impact on states in any regard. So, you know, I think it's worth stressing that Massachusetts versus EPA did not suggest that any time a state has a claim against an administrative agency, it's all, you know, all systems are go. To the contrary, it was because the court had some, you know, correct or incorrect sense of Massachusetts's unique status under the Clean Air Act that led it to find standing.
You know, I mean, it's a fair point that in Massachusetts v. EPA, the court did, I think, point towards the fact that the states are participants in the process. But ultimately, the court's analysis, its actual analysis of why the state had standing, it didn't go to that. It didn't even really go to the special solicitude, that throwaway line that the court just put out there. You know, on its face, what they tried to do was construct standing for the state based on the specific loss of coastal property. And here, you know, again, my argument isn't that all states should always have standing to sue under the EPA. It's just that if they do have an individualized injury, and obviously that's the point you and I disagree on here, but if the state has an individualized injury, as I think Texas does in this case, then the APA doesn't provide any additional barriers, and the state doesn't have the additional barrier of looking for another statute that singles out states as prospective participants and litigants.
So, Adam, could Vermont have brought this suit?
Sorry, what?
Could Vermont have brought this case?
Could who have brought the case?
Vermont.
Vermont. You know, again, it comes down to what Vermont's laws are, what their policy is. If Vermont had the same system as Texas that extended driver's license automatically to people with lawful presence in the state, if Vermont's pre-existing statutes provided for the state to incur costs in providing those driver's license, and if Vermont showed evidence either in filings, record filings before the administration or in declarations that they actually were losing money, then I guess I don't see why Vermont wouldn't have standing in this case.
I think that's exactly where you and I disagree. Dean, do we still have time for another question?
Maybe Dean is on mute.
Indeed.
I was on mute. You guys nailed that one. I have activated the phone line of the next caller who might also be on mute. Caller, if you want to take your phone off mute and ask your question.
This is Julie Blake in West Virginia. I have a question about one of the big objections that usually interpose to state standing to sovereign or these quasi-sovereign interests, and that's the old case of Massachusetts versus Mellon. And I know that has been debated a lot in the Supreme Court's decisions, Massachusetts EPA and the Arizona state legislature case. And I was just wondering if you'd touch on that, whether if or how using that older line of cases against state standing would impact what you've been saying today.
I mean, I'll jump in on this because I actually think Adam and I may agree on this, right? I mean, I haven't heard anything Adam has suggested as saying that those cases are wrong insofar as they say that states aren't parens patriae when it comes to suits against the federal government. Right. I think the question is it a legitimate distinction away from those cases to argue, as Texas and Adam do here, that they're suffering a concrete injury and they're not suing as parents patriae, they're suing as an aggrieved party themselves. You know, and my view is it could be in another case. It isn't here. I think Adam's view is it is here. And I think, you know, both of those are without sort of reference to the parents patriae cases. I think the only difference is that I think the parents patriae cases are motivated by this broader sense that state standing ought to be construed, you know, somewhat narrowly. I think Adam thinks that, you know, perhaps they're just a wholly different kettle of fish.
Adam White, a final thought?
Ironically, I was on mute as well. I mean, I have to go back and think about Massachusetts v. Mellon again, because that was the case of taxpayer standing. And taxpayer standing is tricky because, on the one hand, the taxpayers...
Massachusetts wasn't. Frothingham was.
Okay, see, that's it. I was thinking of the Frothingham case. I mean,
they were companion cases. Frothingham was taxpayers trying to challenge the Federal Maternity Act of 1921, and Massachusetts was the state trying to do it.
Yeah, I think in terms of, and again, this comes back to the Fourth Circuit case, the Virginia case. I think federal preemption of state law has been recognized as a basis for state injury. You know, I'd have to match up Massachusetts v. Mellon and the subsequent cases, but I stand by the subsequent case law that preemption is, you know, rightly conceived a proper basis for standing. I wouldn't disagree with that.
Well, gentlemen, we've exhausted the questions from the audience. We're about out of time here. I can give each of you 30 seconds to wrap up if you'd like.
I mean, I think there actually, at the end of the day, isn't all that much daylight between me and Adam. I think we both agree that states ought not to have standing whenever they want to. I think the question is just what would it mean going forward if Texas's standing were upheld by the Supreme Court here? You know, and I think this is probably the biggest point of disagreement between us, right? I think Adam thinks it wouldn't mean that much. Because in future cases, you'd have to have a state that could show a similar injury to the one suffered by Texas here. And I think that could be a lot of states in a lot of cases. And I think that that's a reason why it should be construed narrowly. But, you know, we'll see if the justices agree.
Yeah, and I do think our ultimate disagreement is rather narrow. It goes to what it means for an injury to be actual, imminent, particularized, or generalized. I'd encourage folks to read Steve's article on states' rights and state standing, which came out a few years ago, another couple of good articles. Kevin Walsh of Richmond has a great article on preemption and standing. And recently, Tara Grove of William & Mary has a very interesting article on state standing. It's a very interesting topic. These papers certainly don't agree on, you know, they certainly have their disagreements. And I'd encourage people to read this, all of them, and give them all a fair airing.
Well, let me thank both of you, Professor Vladek and Adam White. We certainly appreciate your time today. Very interesting stuff. Maybe we can have you back and do some sort of post-mortem after the immigration case is decided. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in. And a reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference calls tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about judicial selection and confirmation. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.